So how have we got here? We began this new series by looking at the Bible's big story, one of revelation that we see in Psalm 19, and one of a full revelation in Christ in Hebrews chapter 1. The Bible's big story, on the one hand, of revelation of God saying, "Here I am," and the other of rescue, "Where are you?" It's the Bible's big story. It began with a perfect home in Genesis chapter 1. The Bible storybook described it like this: God looked at everything he had made, perfect, he said. And it was perfect. No tears, no sorrow, no death. A perfect home where you got to walk with God in the cool of the day. And yet, into this perfect home, an enemy comes with a terrible lie. A lie was told. Again, the Bible storybook says, and a terrible lie came into the world. It would never leave. It would live on in every human heart, whispering to every one of God's children, "God doesn't love me." The lie was told, and a choice was made. The consequences, well, they're real, and we're still living with them now. And yet the remarkable thing is that the Bible story doesn't end in Genesis chapter 3. We discover that a promise was given, that a rescuer would come. We're given a glimpse of grace in what God will do, not treating as we deserve. And we have a God who calls for every page of the Bible, just as it whispers Jesus' name, whispers God's call, "Where are you?" But then two Sundays ago, we saw a new beginning. Instead of things getting better, things got worse, and a flood came. There was an ordinary man who was like everyone else, but was different. And in a world where everyone was running from God, Noah is running to God. And God rescues him. Rescues him from judgment, rescues him from the flood. And yet what we discovered is that as Noah comes out of the ark, Noah needs a bigger rescue. Not from a flood, but from what's in here. What he took into the ark. And a rainbow was placed in the sky. And again, the storybook Bible says, and the first thing God did was to make another promise: "I won't ever destroy the world again." And like a warrior who puts away his bow and arrow at the end of a great battle, God said, "See, I have hung up my bow in the clouds." And the question is, well, what direction does that bow now point? And God's war bow is no longer pointing down at his people in judgment, but it's pointing now up to the heart of heaven, to the one who would pay the price. And that's where we've come from, but now this is where we're at in Genesis chapter 11 and the Tower of Babel. And it's one of those stories that's kind of worked its way into all parts of kind of human thinking. It even made it into the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where what you had to put into your ear in order to understand everyone was a Babel fish. And so it's made its way. In fact, I think there's even an app that's called the Babel Fish app that allows you to understand other languages. But the setting of these familiar verses really matter. Just flick over in your Bible, if you've got a Bible open, just flick in chapter 10. And I bet you there's a little bit in you that as you look at chapter 10, you went, "I am so glad we didn't do that this morning. At least I'm so glad I wasn't the one having to read it," because it's just a list of names. And yet, it is much more than a list of names. It gives us a setting of what's about to happen, and then there's another setting that happens in the end of chapter 11. But chapter 10 of Genesis is often described as being the League of Nations. It's a new beginning to celebrate. And in chapter 11, when you begin to tease out and work at it, you discover that there is much to celebrate. Here's a new beginning of culture and of gifts and of talents and people emerging. Here is humanity growing and spreading. Here is humanity fulfilling the purposes of God that we saw in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 7, that we saw in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28, where God said, "Go increase and multiply." There's lots in chapter 10. If you slow down, that you're to celebrate. There's lots of joy. And yet, there's something missing in chapter 10. And so humanity is growing, it's spreading, it's discovering gifts and talents. And yet there is dissatisfaction, there is fear, and there is division. And ultimately, there's joy, but also emptiness. There's celebration, but dissatisfaction. There has to be more to life than this. And so this is how it begins. This is the setting for Genesis chapter 11. This League of Nations, humanity is growing, but there's something missing. Now flick to the how our verses end. Look at what it says from verse 10. And again, you might have gone, oh, you're dancer. We didn't read our way through these this morning either. We didn't have to work out how to pronounce them. But what we discover is that in chapter 10, you've got a League of Nations, and this is really helpful if you have a Bible in front of you. And then in chapter 11, and from verse 10 onwards, it's one family. So do you see how it goes from the many, the big picture, to after what happens at the Tower of Babel, the focus is on one family. And the focus goes all the way to chapter 12 and verse 1 that are the key verses for the whole of the Bible. That somebody once said, chapter 12, in the opening verses of chapter 12, needs the rest of the Bible to understand. And here's what you have, the League of Nations, things to celebrate, but growing dissatisfaction. And then after the Tower of Babel, one family emerges from all the nations, from all the peoples. One family emerges because God's rescue plan is emerging towards a chosen people and towards a promised land, towards satisfaction, towards a place called home, where we go from the big picture to the small picture, which is the main picture of God calling us home through his rescue. There's always a bigger picture. And what is remarkable is that, remember when you were in primary school, you used to have to make those butterflies. Maybe it was only, remember you did half a painting and then you pressed it over and it did a mirror on the end. The Bible does the same. The Bible's beginning and the Bible's end is a mirror of one another. And it's why both books, Genesis and Revelation, we need them together. The Bible starts with this city being built and a tower called Babel. What does the word Babel mean? Gateway to God. So here they're building this tower, and even by its name, the significance is we're going to find our way to God. But the name Babel itself, it means more than that. There's a play in words because it also means confusion. But it's more than that. The word Babel actually means what? Babylon. Babylon, not just the city and not just this empire, but it stands for man living life in God's creation, not just without God, but in rebellion to God. So if the Bible begins with the gateway, it ends, and Genesis is preoccupied with Babel and Babylon, what is the book of Revelation preoccupied with? Babel and Babylon. And the Bible begins with how we lost home. How does it end? How we get home. It begins with humanity building Babylon. How does the Bible end? Babylon being overthrown. And so just as it begins, and so it ends. And unpacked here, already we are looking for a rescuer where we're given a glimpse just in the setting. Think of it for a moment. Look at what it says from verse 10. It says, these are the generations of Ham. And then you read it down, and there's Peleg, and there's Reu, and there's Nahor, and there's Serug, and there's Terah. It's not just building up to the opening verses of chapter 12. Most of these names don't appear again until when? When do they appear again in the Bible? Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 1. So they begin here at the beginning, and we're told that God is saying the rescuer. When do we hear of them again? At the announcement of the birth of the rescuer. And so the setting for the Tower of Babel, for the city being built, matters. It's preparing you not just to tell you the events of what happens or the consequences, it's giving you the bigger picture that a rescuer is on its way, who's going on to undo what happens in Babel, who's going to bring significance and rescue. So here's a question. We've just got 9 verses open us this morning where the setting is screaming and shouting and singing things at us that there's a bigger picture and there's a bigger story that helps us not just understand the Bible, but helps us understand God's rescue. So what's at the heart of what men and women are doing? Why build this city? Why build a tower? I'd imagine that if you've read this for the first time this morning, or you've read it before, I'd imagine when you read it, there was a little bit in you that went, what's the problem? Is that unfair? And I'd imagine that there is even some this morning that have read this passage and thought, God's just in a bad mood. They're doing something that's great. Here is people coming together, one heart, one mind, going in the same direction. Surely that's a thing to celebrate. Surely that's good, yeah? Is anyone else, am I the only one who's read these verses at times and wondered, I'm not sure what's going on because this seems good. Why would God stop us? But it's the whisper of the lie in the Garden of Eden, isn't it? God's out to spoil your fun. God just wants to push you down. God doesn't want you to be the best version of yourself. He doesn't want humanity to thrive. It's the whisper of an enemy. Because here is what's happening. The first thing is that it is men and women looking for significance. Look at how the verses open. It says, come, let us. And verse 4 is the key to understanding it. It's not just let us together. It's saying, let us make a name for ourselves. Look at what it says in verse 4. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Looking for significance, but without God. The second thing that they're looking for is security. They begin to build walls. An impression is that you build walls for two reasons. You build walls to keep something out, and you build walls to keep something in, so that we won't be scattered. And think of what we just said at the big chapter 10, that creation, that humanity is growing, it's fulfilling what it says in Genesis 9 and Genesis 1. What happens at the moment you start building a wall? There's no room. You stop growing. You say, this is enough. And what you discover here is that as they look for security, is that they know that something's not right with the world. And they know that something's not right with them. But it's easier to say that there's something wrong with out there than something wrong in here. And so they build walls. Did anyone read the article in the BBC just now about the tech giants? Did anyone read it in BBC? I have a wee read. It's interesting reading. There are other news outlets. Sometimes it don't need verified. But the BBC's got this article that talks about the tech giants that we have. You know, people that are worth billions of pounds and developing technology and all, some of the kind of slightly unsettling stuff around AI. Do you know what a majority of them are doing just now? They're doing something that's called doom prepping. What's doom prepping? So if you go to Mark Zuckerberg, what you'll discover is that underneath his house, he's built this massive bunker that would sustain him and his family in the event of some major catastrophe in the world. And the tech giant, and when people look at the tech giants going, why are all the tech giants doom preparing? Why are they doing all this? People begin to get suspicious, and that's where conspiracy and everything else come from it. But the article's got this interesting line. It says, the major flaw of the tech giants is this. They interviewed one of the security guards and said, you know, what is it they're doing? He said, they're building this, and it's secrecy, and the builders have signed NDAs, etc. But the problem that Mark Zuckerberg has this, that one of the guards said, you know, if doom happened, what would you do? Because there's these walls built to keep you on the outside. Oh, it's simple. We would shoot him, and we would go in. But you see the point? They're doom prepping. Genesis chapter 11. It's not new. And so they're looking for significance. They're looking for security. They use shoddy materials. It's described as they're making self-made bricks and bitumen rather than stone and mortar. But at the heart of it, they're acting in sedition. They want to live life without God. They believe that you can reach up to God. It is the Scottish boast of wha's like us. And it's not as much what is being said in these verses, it is what is not being said. But at the heart of it, what you have are men and women looking for significance, looking for security, using shoddy materials, but acting in sedition. So let me give you a hymn and a poem that illustrates it. I wonder if you've ever read Shelley's poem, Ozymandias, or Ozymandias. It's very short. He's one of the romantics. It shows that I'm now out of my own depth. But he wrote a very short poem that was entitled this. And if you've got time, just Google it later. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in a desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frowned and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. So have in your mind a statue in the sand from a bygone age, broken down. One stood proudly, drew everyone's attention, drew everyone's eye. And then on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away. Now what Shelley, who wasn't a man of faith, pointed to is what a hymn gets right. Human pride and earthly glory, sword and crown betray his trust. What with care and toil he buildeth, tower and temple fall to dust. Significance, security. And so we build our empires. We build our walls and act in sedition and end up with what? Nothing but dust. For at the heart of these verses, what lies there is the pride of the human heart. It's those who want to make a name for themselves. It's those who are preoccupied with a legacy, who want everyone to know, I was here. And yet the legacy that we leave, Revelation in chapter 18 in verse 5 describes it like this, speaking about Babylon, for her sins are piled up to heaven and God has remembered her crimes. That's our legacy. Living in God's world as if we were God. And in many ways, the Bible is a story of the tale of two cities. It is of two kingdoms, the walls that we build. And we always say, you look, the enemy is always out there. Think of what's happening just now with identity politics and Christian nationalism, and think of what's happening in our own country. Isn't it always the case it's the people out there that are the problem? We never had a housing crisis until immigrants came. We never had a problem with sexual assault until people came in boats, did we? They're the problem. There's always someone else to blame. But think of it for a moment. What are the commands that all of us break? What are the commands that are being broken just as this city's walls are being put up and the tower is being made? On the one hand, they are saying there is no love for God. Look at what we can make of life without God. Imagine, said John Lennon. And yet as we build our walls, no love for our neighbor. No love for them. And the lives that we build only seem good if self is at the center. The empire that we build, that we make, only feels good if I get to reign. And the pride of man is saying to God, God, we don't need you. We can find significance in the work of our own hands. We can find security in the walls that we bring. We can reach up to you. We can create heaven and earth. We don't need you, God. We don't need rescued. And so we build the walls and we say the problem is out there, but we never have to ask about what's in here. And what does God do in response? What God does here in Genesis chapter 11 is that he comes down. Not in mercy, but in judgment. And he asks, have you loved me with all your heart, with all your soul and all your mind? Have you loved your neighbor as yourself? And we go, but who's my neighbor? God comes down, but in judgment. And what if his judgment is his mercy? Where he sees the direction of our life, where he sees the direction of our communities, where he sees the directions of our society, where he sees the direction and the choices that we're making, and he comes in judgment, and his judgment is a mercy of not that way, but this way, because we need rescued from ourselves and the belief that we can save ourselves. Here's a question. What is God stopping in the Tower of Babel? It's a society that says, I don't need to love God with all my heart, with all my soul, and I don't need to love my neighbor as myself. Let me ask you, in what direction is our society going? Why is it still remains the number one top funeral song? I did it my way. Because we build our little cities with our little towers to shut everyone else out and to live life with self on the throne. It's a temptation for us all. Love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. If God was to come down, what would he need to stop? But here's the bigger picture. The bigger picture, the gigger picture. What's the bigger picture? That our world is growing, but the emptiness is still here. We're building the tower. But it's never going to reach. Despite our best efforts, the problem is not out there. The problem is in here. We're still morally bankrupt. What happens to every great civilization? What happened to the British Empire? What happened to the Roman Empire? What happened to the Mongol Empire? Choose your empire. What happened to the Byzantines? Where's Julius Caesar? Do you know how many documents exist proving the existence of Julius Caesar? 12. How many Jesus? 25,000. Where is he? Whatever happened to Alexander the Great, who wept because there was nothing else to conquer? Despite our best efforts, we are still morally bankrupt, because what happens to every great civilization is that it falls from within, because it takes into itself the seeds of its own destruction. Your worst enemy, it's not out there, but in here. And we can build our walls. We can build our towers. But if God was to come down, what would he find? But what is God's answer? God's answer is that there is a new day coming. Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 9 says, "Then I will purify the lips of the peoples, that all of them may call on the name of the Lord." The day of Pentecost was coming. The storybook Bible describes it beautifully like this. It says, you see, God knew however high they reached, however hard they tried, people would never get back to heaven by themselves. People didn't need a staircase. They needed a rescuer. Because the way back to heaven wasn't a staircase. It was a person. People could never reach up to heaven, so that heaven would have to come down to them. And one day it would. What happens right after these names are repeated in Matthew's gospel? It speaks about a rescue. It's why we sing "Love Came Down" at Christmas. Love all lovely, love divine. If you get time later, read from Matthew chapter 1 in verse 18. Where Jesus comes down, and what name is he given? Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. It speaks about a new city in Revelation 21. Think again of that butterfly. We're now at the other end. Think of what it says in Revelation. If you get time later, read Revelation 21 in verse 22 onwards, where it speaks about the glory of God being where? Out there? No. We are where he is. And so here is God's answer to our empire building, our towers. He comes down. But this time not in judgment. But this time to rescue. I am with you. So that you might live in a new city. So that no towers would be needed. There would be no more tears. Where you would find significance and security and home. And so as the Bible starts with Babel, it ends with heaven, where the question is, where do you want to live? Do you want him to come down in judgment and treat you as you are? Or do you want him to come down in love and grace and to take you home?